This film is a fucking mess. Radio Drone. It is a Thursday night. I am Josh Hadley, and they're here. By there, of course, I mean Cecil T.
Carol Ann? Carol Ann!
That's two.
Carol Ann.
And Peter's doing it too. See how many times we say Carol Ann in this goddamn episode. But then we've got a special guest with us. Mike, are you going to say Carol Ann?
Not just yet. I'm saving it.
Do you know what you don't save, though? You don't save going to adamandeve.com. You save when you go to adamandeve.com. You use the promo code DROME, and you get 10 free gifts on top of whatever you order. You get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping. And we promise there'll probably not be any poltergeists there. We're going to talk Poltergeist tonight. The franchise, which goes on a little longer than most people realize it does, we'll get into that. With the new remake, which looks terrible, none of us have seen it because it doesn't open until next week, coming out, this is a perfect time to revisit one of the strangest franchises out there. Because most people remember the first film, and then they go, how many sequels were there? Before we get into each individual film, what do you think of the franchise as a whole?
If I had to describe it in one word, it would be uneven. It's, yeah. There's a reason why people don't necessarily know of the other films. I wasn't aware that there was a television show whatsoever.
Four seasons, Mike.
Oh, my God. That's just crazy. That is, oh, wow. But, yeah, I personally gave up after two, and I didn't even, I think I knew that there was a three, but I hadn't seen it until just a couple weeks ago.
I agree. It is kind of uneven. I'll say that in terms of it starts out very strong. First one, obviously, a classic. One of those movies that, looking back on Tobe Hooper's career, like at least in my opinion, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre and it's Poltergeist. Those would be his two most solid movies, at least if you were to ask me. And then Poltergeist 2 is kind of weird. And that's summary for it. It's a weird film. Kind of forgettable as well. And then the third one was surprisingly solid, a lot more solid than I actually remember it being. So yeah, it's kind of, you go up, then you plummet downward very, very far, and then you go up again a bit. And then, yeah, the series is, I actually remember the series, not very fondly, to be perfectly honest, but yeah.
The first Poltergeist is one of the scariest movies ever. It's a movie that is just simply amazing. It still creeps me out to this day, mostly because I hate ghosts. It takes quite a dive after that. Like, the first one is just seriously one of the best movies ever, and then the sequel is like a major drop off. It's not a terrible movie, but it's just, by comparison to the first one, it's like if the first one didn't exist, you know, it wouldn't be really looked at as that bad. It's not awful. It's just kind of it's okay. And then the third one, I liked the concept of it. It was a little better. It's just I like that they moved into the high rise and all that. And then as far as the series goes, I only really saw a couple of random episodes here and there, and it seemed more, it was just a in name only TV series.
So the way I look at the franchise is, this didn't need to be a franchise, but I got to agree with Mike and Peter in this, that it's very uneven. But like Peter said, after the severe drop off with two, it does try to climb back up with three. Let's start with 1982's Poltergeist. The film ostensibly is directed by Tobe Hooper. There are debates on how much he actually directed in this. It's produced and co-written by Steven Spielberg, uncredited, and made by MGM. Now, at the same time, Spielberg is making E.T., so that's why he can't officially direct this film. Numerous stories from the set say, while Tobe Hooper was picking camera angles and whatnot, Spielberg had the final say. At one point, the special effects guys said they actually bypassed Tobe Hooper because everything he okayed, Spielberg then shot down and just started bringing special effects ideas and things straight to Spielberg. You knew that could not have sat well with Tobe Hooper. But the first film is a fantastic film. It's one of the most genuinely scary films. Just watching it last week, I still got goosebumps at that goddamn creature in the hallway that attacks Jo Beth Williams when she's in her panties and the hockey jersey. That goddamn tree. Because when I first saw Poltergeist, I saw it the night it debuted on HBO. It was raining, and I had a tree outside my window. So, yeah, that combination after watching this movie, I did not sleep for a day or two.
I don't know what my mom was thinking, but I saw this thing in theaters. Well, I guess it was, what, PG at the time? Well,
originally, this was rated R, but then they got it bargained down to a PG, since PG-13 wouldn't exist for two more years.
So I'm 10 years old when I see this the first time. Obviously, it scared the f*** out of me. I mean, that was crazy. And there are scenes that I still can't watch today. The guy peeling the skin off his face, I still have to look away. I've never actually seen that scene.
Hallway monster with Jo Beth Williams?
The hallway monster, I love that. The pacing and when that hallway monster shows up is just beautiful, because you think that things can't get any crazier than they are. And then when that manifestation of the poltergeist happens, otherwise, like, you're not necessarily seeing like physical forms too often. You know, you see the face in the closet, this kind of stuff, but like, that's a fully realized creature, and just the way it's designed and everything, it's like, oh my god, this is crazy. And just the pacing of the movie, I mean, to go from, you know, where we're at the beginning with the television and all that, and then kind of the fun times with Carol Ann scooting across the floor. I mean, yeah, oh, it stacks chairs. This is delightful. This is kind of funny.
That is also a creepy-ass scene, because this is definitely a Tobe Hooper shot scene. The camera doesn't cut. Hands over to follow Jo Beth Williams, and then it follows her back and the chairs are there. You tell me the first time you saw that you didn't jump to the ceiling.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. And yeah, I mean, it plays on all kinds of childhood fears and adult fears. I mean, the clown, the tree, so many things. And again, with the pacing, I mean, just having, you know, the little kid counting the thunderclap after the lightning and all that, I mean, just amazing. And just him getting more and more frantic, just such great stuff. And it surprisingly holds up. Like, I was afraid when I went back to watch this one just a couple years ago, and then again for the show, I was like, well, I remember it being fantastic, but that's coming from someone, you know, I know that I saw it when I was in my teens and stuff, but, you know, there was a good 20 years where I hadn't seen the film, and I was like, well, maybe I overestimate this movie, but fortunately, it really stays with you, and it really still packs a punch.
That fucking clown.
That clown. Are you referring to the way the arms wrap around Robbie's neck?
Oh, yeah.
And that tree, like, I think that tree could be, a lot could be said about that, because I think the people who saw that movie when they were young, I think that manifested that whole fear of something outside your window. Like, if you had a tree, as Josh was saying, the first time you saw it, you were freaked out by the tree outside your window. I think that really brought upon that fear of something scraping up against your window. Like people saw that and started getting freaked out by that. And just the whole thing is great. That monster in the hallway and then the direction. And I love how there are certain moments in the film where it's, you can kind of tell something is Spielberg, and you can kind of tell that something is Tobe Hooper.
The spirits coming down the stairs and on the video camera, that is totally Spielberg.
Absolutely. It really has that vibe to it. And then, of course, you have the corpses that are coming out of the ground, which is very Tobe Hooper, especially. Wasn't it the trivia that they were actual corpses used in the scene?
Real skeletons, because they were actually cheaper to buy than the plastic ones.
What does that say about the quality of life, right?
So that's like, that kind of gives you a bit of a Tobe Hooper raw kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibe. And the face peeling scene is just, that still to this day for me is one of the most gruesome moments in a film, like in a horror movie, that's like meant to mostly be like a ghost story kind of thing. And then you just get this like gruesome scene of just flesh and
which is actually a Spielberg directed scene. Those are Spielberg's hands pulling the face off, literally.
Oh, God.
He's in that scene and directing it.
And that's surprising to me that that's Spielberg, because to me that was like much more of a like a visceral Toby Hooper kind of scene. But I love it. Just the whole movie from start to finish has just an amazing vibe to it. And it really sticks with you. That's the thing, as Mike was saying, it really does. It holds up absolutely perfectly well. You watch it and it's awesome. And you can go back like 15, 20 years later, watch it again. And it's still the same. Just incredible film. Like, I love Poltergeist.
Like I said when I started, I mean, the first movie, it was just amazing. I don't remember exactly when I see it, but when I first saw it, but I know that I was way too young to actually be watching it.
That sounds like it's the case with all of us. We should not have been watching this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I was at least not. 6 or 7.
Yeah, I think I was in single digits at the time. And I should not have been seeing that movie. The thing that does crack me up, though, a lot of people are freaked out by the clown. The clown never bothered me. The clown, I guess, because I know the clown is one of those things that just freaks people out. That I actually thought was more funny than anything.
I know what freaked you out. Incredible Hulk riding a horse flying around the room.
Oh, God. When they open the door and the lamp is flying by and the light bulb screws in and like, because when that was just so freaky.
The record player is going.
Oh, God.
No, it's not even a record player. It's a compass touching the record and somehow making music.
Right, right. Well, that was great because it was set up so perfectly, because the ghost hunter was like, we were filming this car and it moved across the room, you know, and it took, you know, several hours or whatever. And they're like, oh, that's nice. And they open a door and just hell is breaking loose. It was so great. The tree did get me. The tree freaked me out. And the chair scene, we talked about that before, about how just, it, you know, pans away, comes back, boom, all the chairs are sitting up on the table. Perfect example of how to properly do a boo scare or a jump scare, but it's not like, you know, a cat jumping out of a closet or something. That was an unexpected, holy shit moment. Yeah, just so good. And the when the wife is in the pool and all the corpses are coming out, that had a very Spielberg feel to it, a very kind of, you know, Indiana Jones type vibe to it. Just the way that it was shot. Oh, man, I just adore the movie. It's so freaking creepy and weird. I watched it maybe a year ago was the last time I watched it, and still absolutely holds up. Practical effects are amazing. The scares are just creepy as hell. That spirit in the hallway is just one of the most amazing, like, puppetry mixed with optical effects ever. It just still looks terrifying.
I personally love the idea of the bi-location when they throw the rope and the tennis balls through, and then the black guy is pulling on the rope, and then Carol Ann and Diane come falling through, and they're all covered in that ectoplasm. I'm like, that is just fantastic. Because it looks, I guess I can't say realistic because we don't know what that would really look like, but about as realistic as you would imagine it would. And that's 1982.
Yeah.
Their bodies like thumping on the floor. I mean, just so many memorable shots in that film.
Or the whatever that bites the guy who ends up tearing his face off.
Oh, yeah.
When he picks up his shirt and there's those giant teeth marks of something in his side.
Oh.
It was like,
The thing that gets me, though, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the remake is probably going to cost at least 3 to 4 times that. And it's going to look like garbage by comparison. I mean, because if the shots in the trailer are any indication, it's nothing but like CGI scares. There's not going to be any genuine scares. They're going to have a lot of people. Oh my God, it's so terrifying. And it's just not to go off on a tangent about the remake, but you know, that's just my bias showing. I don't think the remake is going to be anything remotely good.
I don't know how many times they say Carol Ann in these movies. All three of these are Carol Ann, the villains say Carol Ann, because we get a villain for parts two and three. The villain says Carol Ann constantly. The parents are constantly saying it. The other actors are saying it. It's like, okay, we get it. Her name's Carol Ann. Now, a piece of weird trivia here. Carol Ann was almost not played by Heather O'Rourke. Drew Barrymore auditioned for that role. Spielberg liked her, but he didn't quite think she was right for that, so he cast her in the other movie he was making, E.T. Probably was a was a good move on her for her career. But I gotta say, this definitely stands for especially part three. Heather O'Rourke, in this film, she's 5 years old. She gives a hell of a performance.
Mm-hmm.
She is really good. And then she gives a fantastic performance in the third film that if she had not died from a bowel obstruction, I think Heather O'Rourke would have been a force to reckon with in Hollywood because she was a seriously good actress. This film made a ton of money at the box office. This thing grabbed pop culture, and "They're here" became a goddamn catchphrase. So inevitably a sequel was going to happen. They started on a sequel right away. The same writers came back. This time Spielberg did not. Tobe Hooper did not. Because Tobe Hooper, you'll notice he and Spielberg never worked together again. Because at Spielberg's insistence, although he claims this was the studio doing it, Hooper claims it was Spielberg that ordered it. Go and rewatch the very first trailer for this movie. Steven Spielberg presents a Steven Spielberg film, Poltergeist. Only in the little text at the end can you see directed by Tobe Hooper.
You hear stories over the years and all this kind of stuff, and I don't know necessarily who to believe. And of course, Hooper's going to paint himself in the best light, and he's like, oh, no, it's all me. But there are so many scenes that just do feel like they are so Spielberg. And then to Cecil's point, as far as like he was capable of directing so many different styles at the particular time. He still can these days, but it's generally more, you know, drama kind of stuff or light comedy, you know, rather than, with the exception of like something like a Munich or Amistad. But then you get those horrifying moments in Raiders of the Lost Ark, like with Marion in the Well of the Souls. So it's like, okay, he's capable of doing this stuff. So that kind of throws everything up in the air. It's like, was he capable of directing everything in Poltergeist? Yes. Was Tobe Hooper capable of directing everything in Poltergeist? I'm not really sure, because like right after this he does Life Force, and you know, it's not the best directed film in the world. I won't say Poltergeist is the best directed film in the world, but it feels like it was written by two authors. You know, you get the idea that there was, I don't want to say collaboration because it doesn't sound like that, it sounds more like a rivalry, but it definitely feels like there were two people working on it. Which, how much was Spielberg, how much was Hooper, I'm not sure what the percentages are, but I would definitely say that Spielberg had his hands in it more than just being a director, more than just being a producer. And, you know, this was that time when Spielberg was a brand name. You know, he could do no wrong at this particular point in his career. I mean, you look back at some of the other films that, you know, Steven Spielberg presents, and it's like, okay, who was that? Who directed this movie? Was it as, you know, it's like there were times where it's like, well, did Spielberg direct Gremlins? I'm, you know, 12 years old. It's like his name's all over this thing. He was the franchise, you know, he was the guy that, you know, when his name was on a movie, you're going to get, you know, the box office. So it's like, oh, what did he do? Goonies? What?
Actually, Mike, to your point, Jo Beth Williams was not interested in the movie until she knew Spielberg was producing it. She initially got the script and said, I don't want to do a horror film. And then her agent said, it's produced by Steven Spielberg. She said, oh. So that directly goes to your point.
Yeah, I don't think that some of those movies would get made unless he was behind it.
Well, it definitely sounds like Hooper was muscled a fair bit. Spielberg took control of a lot of scenes and definitely added his spin to the film, his own elements. But I definitely feel a Hooper presence there, and I think he does deserve some credit, even though, as Mike pointed out, he did go on to direct things like Life Force. And I'm a fan of that movie. I love Life Force, but it's kind of like, if you look at Hooper's career, his track record of movies after, you know, Chainsaw Massacre, after Poltergeist, they're not the best movies. It almost kind of feels like he maybe hit a stroke of fluke luck when he had to work with a very minuscule budget, and then when he actually had money to work with, not the best movies. But I do give Hooper credit, because I can definitely feel him in certain scenes, and you can definitely feel Spielberg in certain scenes as well. And to Hooper's credit, it sounds like he was kind of muscled Spielberg in his his presence, because everybody wanted to work with the guy. Everybody knew his reputation and how good he was, so it was probably very easy for him to step in and go, nah, you know, we're gonna refilm this like this. And nobody could really bat an eye to that because it's fucking Steven Spielberg.
This whole thing kind of reminds me of when the movie Hero, the Jet Li movie, came out, and it was Quentin Tarantino presents Hero. Like, they plastered that all over the place. And walking out of the theater, there were a couple of guys that were like, wow, Tarantino can make any kind of movie. It's like, oh, no, Tarantino didn't direct that one. He just kind of was the fuel behind getting that released in the U.S., and he did that with a bunch of movies.
He was essentially the distributor on that one.
Yeah, but they plastered his name all over it, and they did that with Tim Burton's another one that they love to put his name all over it.
I mean, people think he directed Nightmare Before Christmas.
It's like, no, Henry Selick did. What? And it's like, no, that was a Tim Burton movie. It's like, no, you got to give the guy freaking his credit, you know? But yeah. With going to Poltergeist, having Spielberg's name attached to it definitely gives it that extra element of credence, because I mean, we know who Toby Hooper is, but there are a lot of people in general who have no idea who that is. And so, you know, having Toby Hooper's Poltergeist wouldn't have as much weight behind it as Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist. Now, whether or not Spielberg directed the whole thing or armchair directed it, it does definitely have moments where it feels more like a Spielberg movie than a Toby Hooper movie. So I would probably say it's somewhere about like maybe 60-40, where it's 60 Spielberg, because there were probably scenes where Hooper was, you know, setting things up, and then Spielberg kind of muscled in and, you know, maybe changed a little bit here, changed a little bit there, made it a little bit more of the way that he wanted it to. The thing that's kind of crazy is it sucks that happened, but the end result is amazing.
Yeah.
So I almost kind of am glad that it did, because it I mean, who knows? Maybe if Toby Hooper was completely in charge, it may not have turned out as well as it could. It's one of those, like, you know, who knows how it would have. It probably would have been good. I think that Toby Hooper is great. I've loved almost all of his movies. But
you haven't seen Spontaneous Combustion, then.
I said almost all. I didn't say all. But I have not seen Spontaneous Combustion. But so I think that it was probably, more than half was Spielberg.
Inevitably, they were going to make a sequel. Well, that sequel didn't come until 1986, when Poltergeist 2 The Other Side was released. Now, Mike, you and I were talking privately about this, and I'm going to quote you because I think you summed it up perfectly. This film is a fucking mess. Because you were 100% right. This film is a complete mess. There are reasons for it. Some of those reasons are directly at the feet of director Brian Gibson. Some of them are not. For one thing, prior to this, Brian Gibson had only directed a couple of documentaries and a small TV movie for the BBC about punk rock. So I don't know if he was the right man to do this, but he seemed to go in with the same arrogance that John Borman went into Exorcist 2 with. I don't want to make the same film again. I want to take this into another direction. That's almost exactly what John Borman said about Exorcist 2. You get the feeling watching Poltergeist 2 The Other Side that Gibson absolutely does not want to make a horror film. Mm-hmm. He wants to make a spiritual Native American film about love conquering all.
Yeah.
And the horror elements are just sprinkled throughout, like he had to put them in there. But you really get the feeling he did not want to make a horror film. And I'll get into why it's such a mess later, but for right now,
I was really excited about 2 because the first one was so good and I was still relatively young. I didn't know that, like, different directors and whatnot was going to go into something. So when I went into Poltergeist 2, I was expecting more of Poltergeist 1. So then, you know, because it had almost the entire original cast, with the exception of, you know, Dunn, who unfortunately got murdered, I was reared up. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. And the practical effects were just not as good.
I want to point out, this film, which I agree with you, has terrible, terrible effects. Maybe just because I'm seeing them on DVD, they don't hold up. The effects are bad, Academy Award nominated.
Wow, really?
I was shocked when I read that, because when my wife and I were rewatching this, we were both marveling at how obvious the matte lines and whatnot are, and this thing got nominated for Best Special Effects.
Wow, it must have been a slow year or something, because they were noticeably bad. And I usually will err in favor of practicals, but yeah, the lines and everything were just, I mean, the green screen work and everything, or actually back then it would have been blue screen, was just so blatantly obvious. It stuck out like a sore thumb. I'm on the fence as to whether or not the old guy was creepy, because he did have the right look.
Julian Beck was creepy, and he was actually dying at the time of stomach cancer. That's why he was so creepy and gaunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did, like, his eyes were sunken back into his head, and it had a little bit of a Children of the Corn vibe to it. It didn't scare me, like you said. It was like he was trying to not make a horror film. I didn't hate it. I really thought it was just like okay. I am curious though, because there is supposed to be, the original cut was 131 minutes. And it fills in all.
I'll talk about all of that in a little bit. I've got a lot of background on this about why it's the mess that it is.
Why it's 91 minutes and not 131. I mean, that's a monstrous chop out of the film. Mm-hmm. And
I'll go into that after I talk to Peter and Mike.
Okay, because it just feels empty at points. Yeah, it was a major drop off from the original.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I was the guy who you quoted before about it being a major mess. When I saw it when I was 14 at the theater, it was a mess then. You know, it was so uneven, and that weird kind of blending of Native American mysticism. So the original house was built on an Indian graveyard. All right, I got that. You moved the tombstones, you didn't move the bodies. Okay, you know, well, at first I thought it was just a graveyard. Now it's an Indian graveyard, but no, there's something buried underneath the graveyard. It's just like, wait, what is going on? How many layers deep
and
are
I
want to
point
go?
Out, it was not an Indian graveyard in the first one. Remember, there were watches from the 70s and stuff like that?
Thank
it was
you.
Not an Indian graveyard in the first film.
Yeah, because most Indian graveyards don't have headstones, I would think. It would just be buried under the ground.
And those were very modern coffins popping up at the end, too.
So you've got now this Native American stuff kind of grafted onto it, plus this like Jim Jones Heaven's Gate suicide cult kind of thing going on, and it's like, this is a bridge too far. This just is one too many things for me to be able to bite off. And now the ghosts are chasing them, and then you have the whole thing with Joe Beth Williams's mother, and it's just like, what is happening with this stuff? I mean, just, it was too much. It just went in way too many directions. And really, when I was trying to remember how this thing ends, I was like, there seems like there's a point where Julian Beck's character just disappears for a while. It's like he kind of comes back with that wormy monster thing, like it kind of looks like him, the guy who doesn't have any legs, you know, crawling out of the room, but really it feels like he just goes away. And as far as is he scary or not, just wanted to say that I remember an MTV special where they were interviewing the members of Anthrax, of all people, and they were talking about their favorite horror movies, and they showed the scene of him outside the screen door shouting, "You're going to die," out in there. And when he raises his finger up to his head, I remember Scotty and being like, "Look at that man. Even his finger's scary."
Well, and the thing with Julian Beck was he died right after he made this movie. He never got to see a rough cut of it. He died right after filming. He was also set up to be a big, bad, recurring villain on Miami Vice. And then when he died, they just dropped his character. And even though it was almost the entire season 2 premiere was set up as, we're laying all the groundwork for this thing. Julian Beck's dead. All right, his character, we're just never going to mention it again on Miami Vice.
It really is a mess, like, undoubtedly. I mean, there's not really much I could add to what Mike said. I think he covered it all pretty well. There's a couple of standout moments. The whole tequila worm monster thing is kind of an interesting concept. And then the big ghost monster at the end just kind of looks like a blue screen blob. Just doesn't look great. It's just what Cecil said about it when Mike said about it. It really covers it. Yeah, the The old sunken-eyed dude is definitely something that stands out as well. As I think that kind of made just little elements of Poltergeist 2 made it stand out as more of a classic than it really is. Just certain visual elements and certain things that people remember. They probably remember it being a lot better than it really is.
I didn't remember it being better than it was. I remembered it not being as bad as it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, was it really that bad? And it's like, yeah, it was.
Because, there was one moment I really loved about this film. When they're arguing with their insurance company over what happened to the house in the first film. That because the house was not technically destroyed, it's only missing so their homeowner's insurance won't pay off. I thought that was really witty, actually.
That was pretty funny, yeah. Like I said, there's little moments here and there that kind of make you remember it fondly. You're like, yeah, the tequila thing, the old scary guy, that joke that you mentioned. It's like, it seems like you look back on it, it's like, was it really that bad? Was it a bad movie? Then you watch it, and it's like, yeah, absolutely. This stunk.
Well, and see, part of my problem was that this whole movie is trying to explain things from the first film that didn't need explanation. Yeah. Now we find out that not only is Diane a psychic who has turned her gift off, but Carol Ann is a psychic now too. And the grandmother has been a psychic, and I guess, you know, we don't know that she has a sister yet at this point, so Trish, we won't meet till the third film, I guess, would be a psychic too. You've got the whole over-explaining now, as Mike pointed out, now it's an Indian burial ground, and then there's another burial ground underneath that because of a crazy preacher cult. Cecil pointed out how long this movie originally was. Now, I don't know exactly what cuts were made at what point, but there are numerous confirmed deleted scenes. The second editor came in. The movie had already been shorn of 17 minutes when he got it, and he was told you need to dump 15 more minutes out of this thing. For some reason, MGM was determined to get the runtime down to 90 minutes, pacing and plot be damned. So he had to get rid of 15 more minutes after 17 minutes had already been sliced out of the movie. Some of the notable deleted scenes. Remember how Taylor said that the Freeling's car was very angry? That wasn't the only angry product that they had. There's a scene where there are production stills of it. Steven cannot put toast into the toaster. It keeps flying across the room to avoid him, and it flies into JoBeth Williams' arms, and only she can put toast in, and Taylor goes, "Toaster, very angry, too." And then he goes, "Fine, I just like cold bread, I guess." And you go, okay, that might have been a funny scene, but it's pointless, so you don't really need it. Probably the biggest deleted scene would have to be Kane's origin. Remember how they have that quick, maybe 20-second shot when Tangina's given the giant exposition dump, and you see them all in old-timey clothes on horseback going through that old town to go to the hole? Mm-hmm. That was a full 8-minute sequence that took place in the past, where remember how Kane remembered that, oh, Taylor, that's what he's calling himself these days? And you're just kind of glossed over. Taylor was a member of Kane's cult, but when he saw the pleasure Kane was getting out of abusing his followers, he realized that Kane was lying and left him. But because of the evil he had committed, he was damned to hell. And so him battling Kane is all about him trying to win his soul back. Is any of that necessary? All of that was shot. Is any of that necessary?
No.
And then there are other scenes. Clearly this scene was shot. Remember how Carol Ann had the red phone where she first started talking to them? There's a scene, it only appears on the back of the British VHS box for this. There's a dream sequence where Kane is trying to pull Carol Ann in through the phone receiver. That scene doesn't appear in any print of the film, but was clearly shot. And then there is a different ending where they battle the demon with a baseball bat instead of a spear. Then there are three other deleted scenes, including one where they explain where Dominic Dunn is away at college. Otherwise, she just doesn't appear in this film anymore. And I think with all of that combined, that's why this movie is a goddamn mess. You had a director who didn't want to make a horror film. You had editors that were constantly being told to take things out. And then you had the special effects, which were horrendous. Like, everyone remembers the tequila vomit monster. Did anyone else notice that the footage was obviously sped up as he was puking it out? Why? They couldn't get the effect to work right, so they just sped it up in post-production. And then there was one shot that I actually turned to my wife and I'm like, that could not have been in the final film. There's no way we just saw that. When they confront Taylor out by their car after they have the little encounter in the restaurant, you can see in the establishing shot, there is desert out there. They are so clearly having this scene on a set of a desert. Did anyone else notice how awfully fake that set looked?
Yeah, it was bad.
I think by that time I kind of tuned out.
Which is totally fair. Speaking of tuning out, so did audiences. This film, it still made its money back, but was not the runaway hit that they wanted. And who knows if the original actor that wanted to play Taylor would have given this more cachet. Originally, I wish I were making this up, Dennis Hopper campaigned to play Taylor.
Wow.
Who knows what that would have done to the box office, either good or bad, huh?
Now, you talked about the scene where they explain that Dominic Dunn's character is away at college. Isn't there a line in the film where it's just like, you and your entire family have to fight this or something? And it's like,
yeah.
Well, what about the girl who's not there? They need to go find her?
You and your entire family that just so happens to be here at the time. You have to fight it.
All of the family that's in California, damn it. Parts in this film came out, I guess 3D was still a thing. The early special effects shots were done to incorporate 3D. That's why the chainsaw and there's a couple of other things that come right at the camera, those were made to be in a 3D version of the movie.
And they look
Those were fairly obvious when I saw them. I was just like, okay, this is like a spear coming right at you.
Yeah. And so it's like this film was just a disaster from the get-go. And like I said, audiences, they thought it was too. Critics destroyed the movie, as they should have. But then inevitably, they were going to make another one. So 1988 comes around. This time, the writers of the first two movies don't want to be involved. None of the cast wants to be involved anymore. Gary Sherman takes over and says, I want to actually do what Gibson said he wanted to do. I really do want to take this into a different direction. Now, instead of suburbia, we're going to move this into the middle of urban Chicago in a modern high-tech high-rise. And
in the Hancock Building.
In the Hancock Building, yes. Now, the only one of the main cast members he could get back was Heather O'Rourke, who by this point is a teenager, and I thought she gave a fantastic performance in this film. I mean, Tom Skerritt and Nancy Allen are always good, but I thought Heather O'Rourke really was stealing this movie. MGM said we need at least one more cast member for a small role. He convinced Zelda Rubinstein. That wasn't a pun. I didn't even mean that. He convinced Zelda Rubinstein on one condition. She pulled a Heston on Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I'll only be in it if you kill me. This was the end of Tangina because that was the only way they could get Zelda Rubinstein back into this film. This time you've got the theme of mirrors and reflections and an alternate world and outside is in. Now Carol Ann is living with her aunt, really doesn't like her, and her aunt's family. Honestly, I thought Poltergeist 3 was a really strong film. I thought it was surprisingly well written, really well paced, and I only found this out after the fact. I was wondering how they were able to do so much with mirrors and not, and I kept looking for the camera because almost all the effects in this movie were done on set. That the reflections you're seeing in the mirrors are actually the set built in reverse on the other side of clear glass. So those were not actually mirrors you were seeing, that you were actually seeing another version of the set built in perfect reverse. And I thought, there's no way that was easy to do, but holy hell did it work. There are problems in the movie.
Loved it. Poltergeist 3 is definitely a treat after having to sludge through the second one. It's one that I haven't seen as much as the other two. Like, I know I've seen two at least a couple times over the years. One I've seen a lot. Three, I think I've only seen like one other time before this episode, and I watched it again. I just finished watching it today, actually. I really liked it. I loved the whole thing, the thing to do with mirrors. Tom Skerritt and Nancy Allen are always awesome, and as you said, little girl playing Carol Ann was really good in this movie, and had she have lived on, I think she definitely, as you said, would have been a force to have been reckoned with. There's some very tense moments Anybody, I think, that especially that lives in a high rise would find this movie a little bit scarier than the suburban living audiences that would, because I do. I live in a high rise, and you know, if you go down to the garage area or to throw out the garbage, and you know, it's pretty creepy, especially after you just watched a ghost movie. So that setting is very good. That cold, kind of desolate, trapped up on the top floor kind of vibe. And also something I noticed about this movie that I didn't notice about the first time I watched it. It's extremely 80s. For an 80s movie, it's 80s. Like it features characters literally talking in the totally red. Like the I think it's like the first 20 or 15 minutes into the movie where they're at the school and the older sister is talking with her friends. And they're just ridiculous 80s stereotypes within the 80s, and it's kind of glorious.
I watched this for the first time just a few weeks ago, so I was not familiar with it at all, and I was really kind of delighted, Peter said, especially after seeing 2 the night before, and I'm like, oh god, now I have to watch 3. Very, very pleasantly surprised. It was really well done in a lot of respects. Really liked the effects. I like the whole idea of that there's that one shot where it's like the multiple Reverend Canes come out of the doors and they're looking at Carol Ann as she's going down the hallway.
Mm.
That really worked for me. It felt a little long in the tooth at the end, and like the whole like magic necklace that they don't really explain and that kind of stuff. I'm like,
I'll explain what the original ending was in a little bit.
It's funny because that was the thing I think I said to you earlier, like when we were talking about the movie. It's like, okay, I saw the movie and I remember it up to a point. I remember it up to the point in the parking garage with the water and the ice and all this kind of stuff. But I really didn't remember the end of the movie at all. And then I just rewatched it today and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, now I know why I didn't remember it. Because it just kind of peters out right towards the end. No offense.
Yeah.
The third one, it cracked me up because there were a lot of people that were saying about how 2 was bad, but 3 was even worse. And that, to me, says that you never saw 3, did you?
Yeah, because 3 is surprising. Usually in a franchise, the third film is not better than the second.
No. I thought that I thought it was cool. I liked the fact that they went into the high rise, that they kind of changed things up. I mean, that's a way to keep things fresh, you know, because it's one of the things that always bothers me with a lot of sequels is that audiences get angry when you don't just do the same thing over and over again. But then if you do the same thing over and over again, then they bitch that you're doing the same thing over and over again. So I like the fact that they took it out of suburbia and they went into the high rise and they went into location that really lended itself well to doing some creepy ass stuff.
Because it was like a real building, all those mirrors and everything. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. they built the stuff that they needed to build, but he said that building was essentially, you know, for the most part, what they shot in.
Yeah, the reverse shots and the Nancy Allen standing there and the ghost turns around on her and like
the frozen parking garage was great. I loved the frozen parking garage.
Yeah, the effects were noticeably better over the second one, and it felt more like a genuinely creepy movie. Again. Not necessarily, you know, not anywhere in league with the first one, but it was good. It's a cool movie, and it's creepy and weird. Carol Ann does give a very, very good performance. You had Lara Flynn Boyle's first movie. She was real young in that, and I dug it. I thought it was cool. I don't think that people should be crapping on it much, because there was the DVD set. It was Poltergeist 2 and 3, and there were people like, oh, they had to include 3 on there because nobody would have bought it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ending. Now, this film didn't have nearly as much post-production tinkering as the second film did. Did anyone else notice in the ending that's on the film, they rescue Donna, they rescue Carol Ann, and Trish rescues Bruce, but nobody bothers to rescue Scott? Did anyone notice that in the theatrical version, or was that just me?
Screw Scott.
Scott, yeah. I guess, doesn't get rescued.
Screw you, Scott. Nobody likes you.
Originally, he did. Apparently, he got left on the cutting room floor. What happened was the studio did not like the original ending. Now, Heather O'Rourke is still alive at this point. The ending is more or less the same as what we get. But remember how Aunt Trish, the one who's actually related to Carol Ann, doesn't care about her and just basically is willing to sacrifice her to get Donna and Bruce back. In the original ending, it was the opposite. That Bruce, played by Tom Skerritt, the one who's not actually related to Carol Ann, loves her so much that he is his love is willing to defeat Kane. The studio didn't like that. They thought that Trish came across basically as a ball-busting bitch, which she kind of did until the end, where she just has this abrupt change in the third act because of Tangina's necklace. So they had to reshoot that. But at that point, Heather O'Rourke had succumbed to her bowel obstruction and died. So you'll notice in the theatrical cut, they never show Carol Ann's face after a certain point. Her face is always buried in Nancy Allen's shoulder. Or she's got the little demon makeup where you can put another actress in there. Mm-hmm. I kind of like the original ending where it's her non-familial relation that loves her so much. Do you agree with the studio, just having not actually seen the footage, but do you agree with the studio that Nancy Allen needed a redemptive moment?
I don't know. I was just not that invested. I don't know. I mean, she did come off as very, very cold when she was just like, hey, you know, it really didn't feel like she was a blood relation with Carol Ann. And just there were a couple moments where I was just like, oh, wow, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah, this is your niece here.
Yeah. But then again, to be honest, it did ring a little true for me. Where it's just like, get this demon child out of here. She's ruining our lives.
Well, to be fair, one thing I thought that this movie did brilliantly, even though the actor that played Dr. Seton wasn't the best actor, I loved how the movie painted him as the complete asshole that we are supposed to hate, but every single thing he does and says in this movie is the logical thing.
Oh, yeah.
That we as the viewers know he's wrong because of the previous two films. To just someone coming into this situation, every single thing he does and says is the logical thing, and he's the asshole. I thought that was actually kind of a ballsy way to take the script.
On the ending versus the theatrical ending versus what was originally planned, I can sort of see why they wanted to maybe change it to redeem her character a bit. I mean, she did in some instances maybe come off as a bit of a bitch, like where she says, like, I have to be with her for 2 weeks. And it's like, well, you kind of get where she's coming from in that she knows what had happened beforehand. And it's like being paranoid of that maybe Carol Ann is going to start some shit again. And obviously not believing the whole ghost thing, because even the school that Carol Ann is going to, that school for gifted children, that professor or teacher dude or whatever is says stuff like how Carol Ann's gift is that she's able to manipulate people to feel and sense and see what she's seeing. And that's what he truly believes. So maybe that's kind of where Nancy Allen is coming from, whereas she doesn't want to be manipulated into seeing things like that and buying into that. Like maybe she's a little reluctant. Like that's what I kind of got from that, is that maybe she didn't so much hate Caroline or was a bitch to her or anything, but just kind of reluctant from the kid's track record. I mean, I think either way, the ending would have worked, whether it was Tom Skerritt kind of doing the martyr line or Nancy Allen. I think either way is fine, because I didn't really see Nancy Allen as that much of a bitch. Really reluctant, maybe, but not a bitch.
Not too much. I think they were. Most of it was just they were posturing to set up for the sequel that never happened.
Yeah, my biggest complaint would be the very last shot before the credits. They've defeated everything. Kane has gone into the light. Tangina's dead. She's gone into the light. And then they've gotten everyone back except for Scott, because screw Scott. Then then there's that big exterior of Chicago, and then lightning strikes the building, and you hear Kane going, I'm like, okay, that shot was unnecessary. Audiences avoided this movie like it was a plague carrier. This movie did no box office at all. This movie lost money for the first time. MGM wasn't sure whether this was due to Heather O'Rourke's death. You know, they already had the release date set. They couldn't, they weren't going to push it back. Or if it was just people, like Cecil pointed out earlier, just for some reason did not like this movie. This one flopped hard. So no more Poltergeist movies. But then in the late 90s, Showtime decided they were already making a series called The Legacy, which is essentially The X-Files through time. A secret society is pulled together to investigate paranormal phenomena and try to keep it out of the public light. So kind of The X-Files in a period setting. Because that was an MGM series, and MGM had the rights to Poltergeist, they called it Poltergeist The Legacy. And I would say Cecil's right in it being an in name only, but in season one, they do name drop the Freeling incident in California as one of the cases they investigated. So I guess they're implying that Taylor and Tangina were part of the legacy.
I didn't think much about it. I mean, it was just, I was hard pressed to really, I mean, the opening scene is so annoying with the kid and arguing with the father and all this
stuff. And the terrible special effects.
And the accents were bothering me for some reason.
Yes.
Why? So, yeah, it was like everything was just not happening for me with this thing. And then, yeah, skimming through it, I'm just like, okay, this feels like so many other failed pilots. So that's what really surprises me, that this thing was picked up and ran for so many years, just because I could really see this being one of those anomalous, like, hey, yeah, here's the pilot for this failed idea, and isn't that funny? But that it got picked up, it's like, you really got to be kidding me.
3 seasons on Showtime and 1 season on Sci-Fi.
Wow.
And the Sci-Fi Channel season 4, somebody got the bright idea. Well, USA Network and Sci-Fi are owned by the same company, Universal. WWE Raw is the most popular show in the history of cable. So season 4 had a bunch of wrestlers as escaped demons from hell that the legacy had to try and get back. I wish I were kidding.
You watched all this show, didn't you?
I didn't watch all of this. I worked at a hotel at the time. You know how hotels in the 90s basically had, you had, you know, basic cable and one pay cable channel that they would always offer. Showtime was the pay cable channel that the hotel I worked at offered. And so on Saturday nights, when I'd go on my 1-hour lunch break, it was usually right around the time a new episode of Legacy was on. So I would just kind of half watch it in the break room while reading a comic book and eating my lunch while working at a hotel. So kind of, Mike, I guess.
I vaguely remember this show, watching kind of as background noise when I would either be doing homework or reading comics, not working at a hotel, just kind of TV would be on. I'd be waiting for something else to be on, so I'd be doing something else. Watching the pilot, which I had never seen before, one word, dreck. Just, I didn't like it. It was kind of a hard sit. That those accents at the beginning, what the f*** was that? Like the weird CG skeleton thing, the goofy skeleton.
Are you saying that even having William Sadler and W. Morgan Shepherd guest starring and Helen Shaver didn't save this for you?
I was actually going to mention William Sadler and say that he was the highlight of it, because it was kind of fun watching him be this this ridiculous demon-possessed dude thing. And then he gets shot, and like the lights that like come out of his body, that like really bad, almost season one of Sliders-esque special effects that come out of his chest when he's being shot. Just wow, you know. After to basically just say that I would probably rather watch Poltergeist 2 than this again. I can safely say
I did not watch the pilot, and I didn't have cable when the show was on Showtime, and when it hit Sci-Fi Channel, just randomly would catch part of an episode here, part of an episode there. It was usually something else was coming on afterwards. So
you watched the last 20 minutes instead of watching something else?
Right. Yeah. I would just kind of throw that on, because that's, you know, back in the days before TiVo and stuff. So it's like, all right, well, this is coming on, so I'll just throw this on and watch this while I'm playing with my Game Boy or something at the time while this is going on. And so I don't remember much.
Now we come to the remake. None of us have seen it. I think I think I can say no one was really looking forward to this movie. No one was really looking forward to a remake of Poltergeist. In all honesty, I would have rather had a fourth film. You probably could have gotten Jo Beth Williams or Craig T. Nelson back. You know, maybe now they're grandparents or something like that. I would have liked a fourth film that maybe showed now in the internet age how Kane might be trying to get at this family or whatnot. But a remake? She's not even Carol Ann in the remake. It seems like almost like a vague, well, we were already going to make a movie that had a similar premise. We have the rights, so now it's a Poltergeist remake. That's what the trailers and all the making ofs I've seen of the remake tell me.
It looks like Boo Scare Central. I mean, again, we're going off of the trailer, and sometimes trailers are just bad. Sometimes the movie ends up being good. But this one, I don't know. From what I've seen of the trailer, it doesn't look too promising. It looks like just they copied some scenes from the original and they added a lot of just nonsense. And I feel really bad because it's got, oh Christ, now I forgot his name.
Sam Rockwell.
It's got Sam Rockwell.
I know. I wish that man could find a good role. He's such a good actor who just takes one bad movie after another.
Well, when he's on, even in bad movies, though, he's good is the thing. Mm. But this movie, I don't know. I have no interest in seeing it. I know Hollywood was determined to make a Poltergeist remake, because this was one of those ones that they had been talking about forever. It was just, you know, Poltergeist movie remake, it's happening. And everyone was like, no one wants this. And then it just, it fell apart and they're not going to make it. And then like a year later, Poltergeist remake, it's like, no one wants this. The reason why they probably didn't do a fourth one was out of some weird honoring of Carol Ann. Like they didn't want to do something without Heather O'Rourke's character with, or replacing her, that might have been wrong. That's the only reason not the only reason. I think that they decided to not do it because of that, but also because right now in Hollywood's eyes, remakes are the thing. Well, here's this property and we'll just give it a new coat of paint. It'll make millions of dollars. And then it ends up failing miserably. So the trailer I've seen worse than Poltergeist as far as remakes lately is Josie and the Pussycats. Or I'm sorry, not Josie and the Pussycats, Jem.
No, see, that was Freudian right there.
No, because actually I like Josie and the Pussycats.
I know, but the Gem trailer is the same damn movie.
No, the Gem trailer is not the same. Well, the Gem trailer is more like Josie and the Pussycats was actually a complete mockery of the whole American recording, the RIAA and whatnot. And Gem and the Holograms is that plot, but done as a serious movie. Yeah, we're not talking about Gem, but Poltergeist, the remake, I will see it at some point, but I have no rush to see it.
Well, I just want to kind of ask you guys, if you remember a couple movies, there was a movie called Robots with Robin Williams, animated film. Do you guys remember that one?
I do remember that.
How about Inkheart? Do you remember that one?
No.
With Brendan Fraser, I remember that one.
Yes, yeah. And, Oz the Great and Powerful with James Franco. I'm sure you guys remember that one. And then there was a musical version of Shrek that was out on Broadway a few years ago. I don't know if you guys happen to remember when that was happening.
I do not.
These are all the credits for the writer of Poltergeist.
I was wondering why you were asking about these movies, man.
Do you remember Monster House? There was another one called City of Ember. Those are the directing credits for the guy who's directing the film. So why the writer and director of these movies? I mean, the guy who directed this movie has done three features, Poltergeist being one of them, City of Ember, and Monster House. And the other guy, more of a playwright and definitely more of a animated feature type guy. Why they're writing Poltergeist? I'm not really sure. So, yeah, the trailer makes it just look like another Insidious, or what was that one with Lily Taylor a couple of years ago? Like those kind of movies.
The Conjuring.
Yes. And it's just like, Yeah, did it happen to have like the clown in the tree and they're just like, hey, we might as well just call this thing Poltergeist.
Gem is truly outrageous. Truly, truly, truly outrageous.
Outrageously bad.
Why?
He's already
why
got his tickets.
There's just no point. I think Mike summed it up with his whole, you know, like going into the
why?
Credits.
Why? I think the question you're asking is, what's the point?
Yeah. And I think, Sean Cunningham did not start out doing slasher films, and Friday the 13th was still a classic. The thing is, he was a fairly new filmmaker and was experimenting with different things. When it comes to this Poltergeist thing, these are people who were predominantly veterans of like family animated features and were getting them to do a remake of one of the most classic, amazingly scary horror films of all time. And at the risk of sounding like a stereotypical film snob who hates remakes, fuck this remake.
I just want to say there is one criticism that's being leveled at the remake that I will not allow people to leave unanswered. I can't even count how many horror websites and horror fans say, oh, it's PG-13. It's going to suck. Guys,
that's
remember
not
the
why
originals.
It's going to suck.
You remember the original's PG, right? This technically has a harder rating than the original. So the whole bitching that it's PG-13, that one I'll defend the movie on.
It's going to suck because it's going to suck, not because of its rating.
When the TV goes off in your house, are they here?
Definitely. I love that you can't even have that central conceit of the television going to static after the national anthem is played.
It should be an infomercial now that comes on and causes the ghosts.
It's an infomercial with Kane there, like trying to sell some, you know, corn pone recipe or something. Yeah, I got grits for you, little child. Yeah. You can chop up these vegetables real good.
I'm going to make you some bacon. These pigs are going to die.
Actually, how scary would it be if the ghost of Billy Mays came to haunt you?
Oh, shit.
My house would be as clean as you could believe, man.
I'm Billy Mays, and I'm here to haunt your house.
Billy Mays would teach you how to get ectoplasm out of your electronics.
Absolutely.
Mike, where can people find you if they want to wait till the national anthem's over?
Come on over to projection-booth.com, and we've got a weekly show there that people can download if they want, and hopefully they like it.
Peter?
For the official Caroline drinking game, you can go to Twitter at Cinematica, Facebook The Cinemasochist, YouTube The Cinemasochist, and once the site is updated, 1201beyond.com for all your
Caroline
drinking game needs.
I'm going to correct you on that. Your stuff has already been added to the site, even though we don't relaunch for another 2 weeks.
Awesome. So
Your stuff is already popped up there.
Kick ass. So yes, you can now officially find The Cinemasochist on 1201beyond.com and help keep the product promoted. Get yourself a Radiodrome t-shirt and pretty soon Cinemasochist t-shirts and other show t-shirts. Just go spend some money, goddammit.
I need money bad. Cecil, unfortunately, you are the mirror vote here, and Trish does not love you. But where can people find you anyway?
I'll be hanging out with Scott at escapistmagazine.com, as well as goodbadflix.com and geekjuicemedia.com.
You can find me where you're looking at on the spiritual realm at 1201beyond.com, and you can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. Try and have a good night, guys, and remember, if the dog is freaking out over the bed after you've smoked dope and your daughter walks in on you, something's weird. that's another thing. I guarantee the remake will not have the parents smoking weed.
Yeah, how did we not? We didn't cover that. I that was something I wanted to mention but didn't. The fact that the parents are very casual and kind of more down to earth than usual stick up the ass parents that you see in horror flicks.
Radio Drome is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.